Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Peter Hart. This week on Counterspin, the Democratic Convention has come and gone. The broadcast networks were practically dragged kicking and screaming to Boston, offering up a paltry 3 hours of primetime coverage and complaining all the while about the lack of real news. So what were the major themes in media coverage from Boston, and did the media's storylines overshadow the convention itself? We'll talk it over with Zachary Roth of the website campaigndesk.org, which is a project of the Columbia Journalism Review. Also on the show, those watching the Democratic Convention seemed perhaps most enthused and excited by the speech by former presidential candidate Al Sharpton, those, that is, who weren't members of the elite press corps. There, Sharpton came in for a drubbing with a vitriol that was quite remarkable. What accounts for media's extreme and obvious discomfort? And what issues in his speech might reporters have engaged had they been of a mind to do so? We'll hear from Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, law professor at Columbia and UCLA, about that story. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a quick look back at recent press.
On August 1st, Homeland Security Director Tom Ridge warned that a possible al-Qaeda plot targeting sites in New York, New Jersey, and Washington, D.C. was serious enough to raise the terror threat level from yellow to orange. Except in New York, of course, where it's been at orange since September 11th. The announcement was big news, of course, carried throughout the media. But over the next day or two, some outlets started to ask questions. The Washington Post and New York Times noted that the intelligence the government was relying on was several years old. Not to be outmaneuvered, the Bush administration countered that new information had come in, and that was the reason they were so concerned. Well, this back and forth left some outlets wondering what to make of the story. As Washington Post executive editor Leonard Downey said to the New York Times, quote, "We're a little confused," close quote. His paper's editorial page had a different take, however, and seemed to want to quell any concern that the White House might be using the threat alerts to their advantage, proclaiming on August 3rd that, quote, "In his statement, Mr. Ridge stayed away from politics," close quote. That doesn't exactly square with what Ridge said at his press conference, which was this, quote, "We must understand that the kind of information available to us today is the result of the president's leadership in the war against terror," close quote. So while the news staff of the paper might be cautious about the government's claims, it seems the editorial page won't let facts get in the way of its support for the Bush administration.
New York Times columnist Paul Krugman wrote a piece on July 30th that took the media to task for not covering important election issues. Krugman read 60 days' worth of television news transcripts, and he came away unimpressed. As he put it, quote, "TV news stopped reporting on candidates' policies and turned instead to trivia that supposedly reveal their personalities. We hear about Mr. Kerry's haircuts, not his health care proposals. We hear about George Bush's brush cutting, not his environmental policies," close quote. Well, it's pretty hard to argue with that if you've watched even a minute of television news, but Jim Murphy, the executive producer of CBS Evening News, certainly did. He posted a letter on a journalism website saying that, quote, "The entire staff of the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather was pretty miffed after reading Paul Krugman's column today that claimed not a single issues piece has aired on the big newscasts in the past 2 months," close quote. Well, a charge like that certainly would be remarkable, but it's not actually what Krugman wrote, of course. He did say that on one specific issue, John Kerry's health care plan, the networks had failed to present basic facts. Quote, "I couldn't even find a clear statement that Mr. Kerry wants to roll back recent high-income tax cuts and use the money to cover most of the uninsured," close quote. That critique certainly applies to CBS Evening News, which aired one segment that presented Kerry's method for financing his health care plan as a mystery. So what's more distressing, that big-time journalists would be so thin-skinned, or that the entire staff of a network news broadcast can't read a newspaper column properly?
And finally, on Counterspin, our main question about election coverage is not whether it's fair to Democrats or fair to Republicans, but whether it's fair to the public. Does it give them enough information about the candidates to cast a considered vote? By that measure, USA Today's August 2nd installments from the Bush and the Kerry campaign trails fell far short. Both focused overwhelmingly on relatively trivial stuff. Still, there's trivia. And there's trivia. The article on Bush's travels did give less room to the substance of anything Bush said than to which of his lines got the biggest applause. Still, the piece began this way, quote, "Crowd reactions to President Bush's new campaign speech provide more evidence that his management of the war on terrorism is his best political asset," close quote. And it went on to say that Bush's muscular new rhetoric capitalizes on polls that indicate that people think he would handle terrorism better than John Kerry. The Kerry article, on the very same page, was a very different story. Forget ideas, it didn't even focus on what audiences thought of Kerry, as much as what they thought of Ben Affleck, who was traveling with the candidate. There was also space given to John Edwards' consumption of diet soda, and the story of Kerry saving a hamster's life. Neither piece is a real service to voters. Still, you couldn't help but be struck by a certain imbalance between the Bush piece, which was headlined, "Talk on Terrorism Draws Cheers," and the Kerry piece, "Tour Stops Include Scenery, Celebrities."
Thank you, Peter. You are listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Fair also publishes a bi-monthly magazine. It's called Extra. I'll give you more information about Extra a little later on in the show.
Some things about political conventions never change. Every 4 years, we're treated to a litany of complaints from the press corps. Conventions are substanceless, scripted, and lack any actual news value. The same was true in Boston as the press pack descended for the Democratic convention. How did the networks and cable news channels cover the proceedings? And did the cable networks give us more face time with the pundits than with the convention speakers? We're joined now in the studio by Zachary Roth. He's been following the media and the election for CampaignDesk.org, a project of the Columbia Journalism Review. Zachary Roth, welcome to Counterspin.
Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with what was probably the primary media theme for the convention. There was a unified party that was not going to engage in any serious criticism of George Bush. We heard countless times that the speeches were being vetted for anything that might be considered quote-unquote off-message. How do you think that theme kind of affected coverage throughout the convention?
Well, you know, it's interesting because obviously, in one way, the fact that the Democrats had such a unified message was good for them. But perversely, I think it also sort of generated a storyline in the coverage where the news media was particularly desperate to come up with any controversy or any conflict. And the Democrats obviously weren't giving it to them because they were so on message. And what that ended up meaning was the news media came up with a whole bunch of different ways to provide that conflict. In part, that meant the usual obsession with sort of the trivial storylines as opposed to the substantive ones. So, for instance, everybody after the convention could say that Teresa Hines Kerry had told a reporter to shove it. Everybody knew that. But not too many people probably could have told you the details or even the basics about John Kerry's healthcare plan, for instance. But that's sort of a pretty usual criticism of political coverage. Another thing that perhaps is more important that happened in Boston was the media became very reliant on Republican spin points to sort of drive their coverage and to create these sort of fake controversies, even to the point of CNN particularly anchors sort of honoring any spin that Republicans generated and emailed to them or phoned into them. So you had, for instance, Jeff Greenfield saying, "Republicans are saying that Michael Dukakis isn't being given prominent placement here. That's a real criticism. What are Democrats saying in response?" And, you know, I think most people understood that, of course, Michael Dukakis wasn't going to get too much prime placement. And, you know, this new group, Swift Boat Veterans for Truth, is attacking John Kerry's military record. Well, anyone who's looked at that for even a little bit knows that these guys are sort of a part of the Republican spin machine. But if it was coming to CNN or to the other outlets from the Republicans or from some allied groups, they gave it its time on the air. And perhaps the worst part of that was showing no willingness on the part of the news anchors to correct any of the blatant untruths that many of the Republican spokespeople came up with. So, for instance, I think it was Mark Rasko was using the line that John Kerry and Edwards are the most liberal and the fourth most liberal senators, respectively. And as any journalist should know, and Wolf Blitzer should certainly know, who was talking to Rasko at the time, that comes from a National Journal study which only looked at 2003, in which Kerry and Edwards were campaigning for most of that time. So to use that as a marker of who's the most liberal is absurd. But Blitzer didn't come back and correct Rasko at all and set the record straight. So that was, I think, a big factor.
Now, many people were curious about how the conservative Fox News channel was going to cover the Democratic convention. As it turned out, according to the group Media Matters, Fox devoted less airtime to the actual speeches than the other cable channels. You wrote something watching, I think, a full day of CNN, so you spent some serious time doing that. What struck you about their coverage in particular?
Well, as I put it in my piece on Campaign Desk, it seemed that they often were adopting some of the most dubious ploys that Fox News itself has been using, perhaps out of a sensitivity to this accusation of liberal bias. They've often sort of bent over backwards to often overcompensate. So in addition to being sort of particularly receptive to these Republican talking points and not correcting any of the untruths that were being said on air, they also showed a weird sort of obsession with finding any divisions between John Kerry and the grassroots of the party. So, for instance, they figured out that, I think by a CNN poll, 85% of the delegates on the floor had opposed the Iraq war. And they made a big deal of this and said, 85% of the delegates oppose the Iraq war, but John Kerry doesn't want to pull troops out of Iraq. Is that a big division between Kerry and his party? And first of all, it's comparing apples and oranges. I mean, the fact that 85% opposed the war doesn't necessarily mean they want troops to return right away. I think if they'd pull on that, they'd have found probably a smaller number. But second of all, and probably more important, it was pretty obvious that the Democrats had decided to agree to disagree on that one, and that they were so motivated by a willingness to kick Bush out of office that they were fine with Kerry's position. But CNN kept coming back to it and painting it as if it were a big source of controversy.
CNN seemed to be doing this even more than Fox. It seemed like with the big speeches, Edwards, Kerry, and the like, as soon as the applause died down, there's Ralph Reed on CNN, much quite quicker than even Fox News Channel was handling this kind of stuff. So it's a very interesting pattern to see CNN kind of outflanking Fox on its right, if that's possible. I know CNN saw your piece on Campaign Desk, and they had some thoughts about your watching CNN for a day and your critique. What did they say in response to your article?
Yeah, they came back and made the argument that we were criticizing them for doing what reporters should be doing, which is being skeptical of the candidates and asking questions and so on. And to some extent, I think that's a fair point. But I think there's a difference between a media which is asking difficult questions and important questions and asking tough questions of both sides, which I think is what we all want to see in the press, on the one hand, and on the other, reporters that are sort of completely dependent on the other side to generate their coverage, and so end up sort of abdicating any sense of editorial judgment about what's a real news story and what's just an absurd sort of spin.
Well, a big story coming out of the convention was the bounce, or specifically the lack of one, for the Kerry campaign in the polls. There was this theory ahead of time about what number was appropriate for how Kerry would improve his standing, and that didn't seem to be the case. He didn't reach any of those benchmarks. What's behind that story? How did it start up, do you think?
Well, you know, one major way in which it started was a Bush campaign spokesman, I think a pollster, Matthew Dowd, who sort of came out with this big prediction. John Kerry should emerge from the Democratic convention with a 15-point bounce in the polls. And everybody who knows anything about this stuff knew as soon as he said it that that was an obvious spin to try to raise expectations so that if he then came out of the convention with anything less than a 15-point bounce, he would be seen as having failed to meet expectations. For some reason, the New York Times in particular, and this was another thing that I wrote about on Campaign Desk, pretty much bought Dowd's spin at face value and said he has a good track record of predicting these things in the past, so Kerry should come out with a 15-point bounce. And obviously, we've seen since the convention that there's a very small number of undecided voters that are still left, and that, in fact, Kerry had a much smaller bounce, maybe 4 or 5%, depending on what poll you look at. And he's failed to meet that. So in some way, that kind of spin did its job.
And now we hear that Dowd and some Republicans are predicting the Bush bounce, kind of using the same strategy in the media. What are they saying now about what Bush is likely to get after the convention?
Right. Well, now, of course, they're saying in this very polarized electorate with so few undecided voters, Bush isn't likely to get any type of bounce at all. And, you know, at least in a few outlets, I've seen that be reported with a completely straight face, as if Dowd is some sort of reliable prognosticator of this stuff.
That old expression, fool me once, something to that effect. Well, the logical question is how the Republican convention will be covered in comparison to the Democratic convention. It's always dangerous to make predictions like this. But based on what you've seen in the political coverage this season and in the convention coverage, what kind of expectations do you have for the media when the Republicans gather in New York?
Well, you know, I would hope that they cover it in just the same way that they covered the Democratic convention, in a very sort of skeptical way, if only because they should treat both sides equally, obviously. But I have to say I do have the expectation that it will be slightly less skeptical, not because I think because the media is biased against Democrats, although I do think the sensitivity to the liberal bias charge does come in a little bit. But more, I think, just because the media is so sort of dependent at this point on the various campaigns for their to drive the coverage and to create these conflicts that they end up slanting towards whichever side is more sort of sophisticated in getting their talking points out. And recently, it does seem that the Republicans still sort of are a little bit more aggressive and hold the edge in that. I was actually talking to a Democrat who is going to be heading up the Democrat sort of response to the Republican convention. And, you know, they have their own operation and they'll be doing a similar thing. She's a 27-year-old activist and she's actually my ex-girlfriend. And, you know, she's not Ed Gillespie. lucky for me, I guess.
We've been speaking with Zachary Roth. He's a reporter for CJR's Campaign Desk. You can follow their work at campaigndesk.org. Zachary Roth, thanks for joining us here on Counterspin.
Thanks very much for having me.
Reporters complain loud and often about how conventions are too scripted, too micromanaged to be interesting. But when someone actually appears to stray from the script, let's just say deeper preferences are revealed. That partly explains the overwhelmingly hostile response of the punditocracy to the speech given by former presidential contender Reverend Al Sharpton, a speech that for many in attendance was evidently a high point of the whole week. Partly explains because a closer look at some of the comments showed an elite press corps that was obviously extremely uncomfortable with the content of Sharpton's remarks and not simply the time he took to make them. So what did Sharpton say that got under journalists' skin, and what does it all say about the place of race and racism in our national discussion? Joining us now to talk about this is Kimberly Williams Crenshaw. She's a professor of law at Columbia and UCLA law schools, as well as a regular commentator on NPR's Tavis Smiley Show. Welcome back to Counterspin, Kim Crenshaw.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
Well, now, you wrote about Al Sharpton's convention speech and some of the responses to it in a piece for Common Dreams. I wonder if, first, particularly for those who, like many that we're hearing from, couldn't even take the networks and went straight to C-SPAN to watch the whole thing, give us just some of the flavor of the response to Sharpton's speech by the press corps.
Well, the response was an overwhelming expression of discomfort, shock. I would say some of it ranged on just sort of this apoplectic, I can't believe he just did that response. Just a couple of words, I think, will characterize it. Judy Woodruff on CNN simply declared, Al Sharpton has just hijacked the convention. I was pretty much bowled over by, first of all, the use of hijacking to talk about what they consider to be an off-script performance. At best, it's a loaded term, but after 9/11, you don't use the term hijacking without being a little bit more careful about what you're trying to convey. Then as he was walking off the stage, one of the other CNN reporters, Candy Crowley, approached him and simply stated, I want to tell you that you were off script. It wasn't a question. It was a declaratory statement. So at that point, it appeared to me that the journalists had ceased reporting and decided that they were going to operate something like a rhetorical security detail, issuing tickets, mm-hmm. you know, for talking outside of the lines. It was like they took it upon themselves to be the disciplinarians for the Democratic Party, and it was stunning because there was such a lack of responsiveness to the substance of what he had to say and a concern about the Kerry people having heartburn, concern about time having wasted. And finally, there was this sense that this might really threaten Edwards' ability to speak to the entire public because Sharpton had gone so over time and it turned so many people off.
Well, let's talk about that time thing, because many of the more kind of nefarious, if you will, comments that came through were sort of couched in this, well, we're really just concerned about protocol. He was supposed to have 6 minutes. He went on for 14 or 20, depending who you listen to.
Yeah.
Was there really any substance to that concern about time?
Well, Donna Brazile was quite clear. When Wolf Blitzer was really upset or appeared to be concerned about the time factor, he turned to Donna Brazile and said, well, what do you think about this situation, and aren't the Kerry people upset? And she said quite clearly, and any other viewer would have known this, that they had padded in plenty of time for anybody going over time. So it wasn't a problem, and as it turned out on that night and other nights, they actually had to come up with filler, so the primetime speakers did actually come on when they were supposed to come on and not too soon. So it really wasn't a concern at all. More interestingly, it's apparently the case from both what we saw on television and from information I've gotten elsewhere, no one in the Kerry campaign has ever themselves said that Al Sharpton went off script or went over time and threatened the lineup. This is just speculation on the part of the media, not based on any serious reporting or investigation.
Well, for folks who didn't hear it, it's hard to really convey some of the flavor of the coverage. We were looking at the MSNBC crew, which featured Howard Fineman of Newsweek, Chris Matthews, and also Doris Kearns Goodwin, who went on about, among many things, who is Sharpton anyway? His whole career is based on a lie. I thought that was a particularly rich commentary coming from admitted plagiarist Doris Kearns Goodwin, who also went on to say that the cheers in the room were like nails on a blackboard. You just couldn't stand to listen to it. Now, am I oversensitive? Because, I mean, it seems to me, and we'll talk about the substance of what he said, but there seemed to me to be an element of the criticism of, won't this black man just shut up?
And I think that you have that in the more harsh way that you just mentioned, and then the more subtle ways. There was an op-ed that was run in the New York Times on Sunday that basically said that Sharpton, as opposed to, say, Barack Obama, is coming out of that old civil rights tradition, which implicitly is divisive, whereas Barack Obama is the kind of black spokesperson that now we really want to hear. And I get the sense from this entire range of commentary that race is just something that the media, as well as the Democratic Party, may want to put behind. We don't want to talk about it anymore. And what really strikes me about it is that in this interpretation, there's this sense that to talk about it is to be uncivil. And there was, quite frankly, nothing uncivil about the retelling of the history of political repression and the fight to get in the Democratic Party. Yet, when Sharpton told that story, number one, most people didn't even know the historical references that he was talking about. I'm struck, all the official transcriptions, when he mentioned Goodman, Cheney, and Schwerner, the three civil rights workers who were murdered in pursuing political rights, all of the transcriptions say it's inaudible. And it only means that the historical references are so unfamiliar to people that they didn't even know who he's talking about. Mm-hmm. Yet telling this story is viewed as demagoguery. They're saying that he was being uncivil. So at the end of the day, it really reminds me of the 60s when people used to say, well, if I have to serve black people, it's violating my civil rights. Well, now it's, if I have to listen to this history of the civil rights struggle, it's violating my right to civility. It's the same kind of repression, but repackaged for 2004.
Now, you did find substantive things in Sharpton's speech that if they wanted to take it more seriously, journalists could have picked up on and talked about. What are some of those questions or issues that Sharpton brought up that journalists might have dug into?
Well, there were some obvious ones. For example, I mean, Al Sharpton has been fairly critical of the Democratic Party, quite frankly, for taking the black vote for granted. So Candy Crowley could have clearly asked him, well, why are you taking issue with what President Bush had to say? Because essentially he just sort of soft-pedaled something that you've been saying throughout the campaign. That would have been something interesting to say. Even more compelling, I think, was his comment about the Supreme Court. That was one of the issues that just did not come up on that podium. And frankly, the battle of the courts, I think, is one of the most significant issues in this campaign. So Jeff Greenfield, rather than saying that Sharpton's comment that had Bush appointed the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas wouldn't have gone to law school, rather than saying that was the most incendiary comment of the whole convention, might have said, what about this issue with the courts? Why isn't the Democratic Party picking this up? What's happening with what should be a staple issue in this constituency? So there are any number of issues that might have been brought up. The last is, why is the Kerry campaign permitting Al Sharpton to speak? Because they know that they cannot win this election without the black vote. So talking about that contradiction might have been an interesting way to go. And frankly, that's what Fox TV did of all networks. So, you know, rather than doing reporting, their policing got in the way of really asking the probing and provocative questions that reporters are supposed to do.
We've been speaking with Kimberly Williams Crenshaw, professor of law at UCLA and Columbia Law Schools, and a regular commentator on NPR's Tavis Smiley Show. Her column, Sharpton Sharpens the Challenge with an Overtime Victory, can be found on commondreams.org. Thank you very much, Kim Crenshaw, for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks for having me, Janine.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group FAIR, based in New York. FAIR also publishes a bi-monthly magazine. It's called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-847-3993. That number again is 1-800-847-3993. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can do that on FAIR's website, which is www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes at Mercer Media. With me is Peter Hart. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.